All right. Greetings. I wore my sriracha shirt because it's hot. But anyway, so we're almost done in John, our penultimate chapter here, chapter 20. Just to remind you a little bit, previously in John we talked about the signs that John talks about, the signs of Christ. You know, we had all of his teachings in the Last Supper, and more recently, his betrayal and crucifixion. The message is sort of the gospel message that we always talk about, because it is such good news, is mentioned early in John, where it says, "Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." Simple message that, you know, just turning towards God, turning and asking for forgiveness for our sins and asking Jesus' death to pay for those sins will earn us the right to become children of God and to live with him in heaven forever. And, you know, that is good news. It is not something that we have to earn. It's not something we need to, you know, do a bunch of song and dance for. It's a simple proposition, something that you could do at any time, anywhere, and reap eternal benefits. That sounds pretty good to me. Today, we will be talking about Jesus' resurrection, which is actually a very important topic, because if Jesus was a good person, he taught good things, and then was killed for his beliefs, that would put him in the company of lots of other people who died for their cause. You know, Spartacus was fighting against slavery, and he was killed and potentially crucified, and why don't we worship him, right? Well, he was... I don't think he ever claimed that he was God, but, you know, he was a man, and he was maybe fighting for something that we believe in, but that's it. You know, Jesus, who had said that he was the Messiah and said that he was God's son, and also said that he would rise from the dead, and then did, really proves that that's something else entirely. So whether you accept that statement or not, you could at least accept that this is something that puts him in a different category from others who also died for their beliefs, that he never claimed that he was just a good person teaching good lessons to people. He always was setting himself apart as being something else, something above just a good person, something that, you know, we believe is, you know, God's son and, you know, able to pay for our sins because of that. Today, you could also look at it as unexpected victory. Maybe it should have been expected victory, but, you know, I'll take unexpected victory. You know, when the Cavs got LeBron James back, that was really unexpected. I did not expect that. I don't actually care for LeBron James, as an aside, but that was really unexpected. I did not think he was coming back. I thought, my brother told me, I just didn't believe him. But that's kind of nice when that happens. You know, you get an unexpected victory. We'll also kind of talk about the idea of seeing and believing, which a lot of times maybe we think must see to believe, and yet maybe not. So anyway, let us begin. So here in John 20, verse 1, it says, early on the first day, oh, quick aside, Jesus had just been killed, so that happens. Anyway, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Now, I'm going to camp out on this briefly, just because, draw your attention to a couple of these details here. You know, while it was still dark, and they mentioned that Mary Magdalene was the one who went to the tomb. So just keep that in your mind's eye. If you have ever read through some of the other gospel accounts, you might have been a little confused by some of the details that get mentioned specifically about what happened after Jesus died and when they're going to the tomb. Who was it who went to the tomb? At what time did they go to the tomb? And some people, and I know this because I've had people tell me this before, feel like, see, the Gospels were contradicting each other, and they were written to correct each other about details like this. And that's why you know that it's not really a unified message, because, you know, there's so many differences. Like, for instance, if we look in Matthew, it says Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, which is just kind of hilarious because that narrows it down to like 100 suspects. But in Mark, it says Mary Magdalene, Mary, mother of James, and Salome. And then in Luke, Mary Magdalene, Mary mother of James, and Joanna. So who was it who actually went? John said it was just Mary Magdalene. Also worth noting, in Matthew it said, as it began to dawn, whereas Mark said very early when the sun had risen, oh, sun's up. And Luke said at early dawn, and John said early while still dark. So sun risen, still dark. See? Contradiction, right? And, you know, I think that you, a casual reader, could see that as being contradictory, and I'm not going to tell you that you're crazy if you think that, because they, I mean, those are different. So, what's the deal with that, right? Is this a problem? Is this actually a contradiction? You know, why would there be differences like this if we're saying that the Bible is God's word, and it's God who is actually giving us this message? Why would you see differences, especially ones that... It couldn't have been dark out and the sun had rose, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. So why are these little differences there? Let's talk about that. Let's look, actually, I studied history in college, and they had us do this exercise where you look at separate accounts of a famous event to see what kind of potential similarities and differences there might be. So I gathered a few accounts of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. All of these are from the same website. It's they've set up tours of the Ground Zero if you ever want to go there. But let's look at some of these, look at some of the similarities, look at some of the differences, and see if we think, these contradict each other, or do we accept them as actually being all authentic? So here's John's account. I was sleeping on September 11, 2001. And was awakened at around 9:15 a.m. by the sound of fire engines, sirens, lots of them. I looked out the apartment window, out into the gorgeous Indian summer day, and I saw a stream of fire trucks racing downtown. A big plume of thick smoke was visible in the sky as I looked south from 24th Street. As I approached downtown near the Brooklyn Bridge exit, I saw the World Trade Center towers. The sight was appalling, wreathed in flames and surrounded by hellish black smoke against the clear blue sky. I stopped. Sitting in my car, barely half a mile from Ground Zero, I saw the South Tower fall. The opaque wall of dust spewed from the collapse and came nearer and nearer, block by block. So, just, I underline some of these details here. He's saying an Indian summer day, which, at least according to me, means that it's sort of summer when it's not supposed to be summer and it's kind of hot out. So there's that detail. And he mentions the clear blue sky. So we'll try to hold on to those details as we look at some of these other accounts. So Linda's account says, on September 11th, I awoke to a delightful break from the sweltering heat and humidity we had endured all summer long. So she's saying it actually wasn't that hot, but it had been hot before. Minor difference. I was singing in a nursing home a distance away from the financial district, and had begun engaging with the residents in the dementia unit when a nurse ran in saying, a small plane just hit the Twin Towers. We ran to the TV and watched in horror, along with 2 billion other people, as the second plane hit. This was no accident. All I could think was, wow, it's going to take a long time to repair this damage. My heart broke into 1,000 different ways as I watched what happened over the next hour or so. Activities director said I could go home if I wanted to, and that the residents of the dementia unit would not really know the difference. Those words struck a nerve in me. I wanted to stay. I wanted to have a few more hours in a room full of people who did not know the world had just changed. So there's Linda's account. We're just going to get one more here. Tom's account. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, I woke up just like any other day. I worked on the 15th floor of 10 Exchange Place in Jersey City, a skyscraper on the Hudson River, right across the Hudson River from the World Trade Center. I remember how nice of a day it was, about 70 degrees with a nice breeze. Sometimes in early September, New York can be sweltering, but that day was as pleasant as they come. I arrived at my office, the trading floor of National Discount Brokers Capital Markets, around 8:30, and started my normal pre-opening bell duties. Around 8:45, the TVs on the trading floor started reporting that a plane had struck the North Tower. This was surprising, but no one panicked. With all the tall buildings in New York City, collisions with planes do happen from time to time. Everyone assumed that it would be an accident involving a small single-engine plane, the floor-to-ceiling windows of our conference room had a direct view of the towers, so we all ran to see them for ourselves. Only a few minutes after getting to the windows, we watched. All of us struck silence as the second plane screamed towards the South Tower. Not only could we tell that it wasn't trying to avoid the building, but that it was accelerating. The explosion when the plane flew into the tower was almost blinding, and we could feel the shockwave hit the windows and set them vibrating. We could hear the rumble from across the river and see the pieces of steel and glass flew out of the South Tower into the clear blue sky. Okay, so there's a lot of detail. I want to point out that there's a lot of similarities in those accounts and a couple of differences. So what does that mean? That there are some differences in there and some similarities. What should we think about these accounts? Right? I mean, do they contradict each other, or would you consider those to be complementary of each other? Who here would assume that those are all fake? I mean, I don't think anybody would. You would assume, well, if you ask three different people for their experiences of what they saw on 9/11, they probably sound a little different. You know, there's little minor differences in the opinion on the weather. There's little minor differences about the timetable, little minor differences about this and this and that. Of course, that's the way that it would be. That's the way that it should be. No one here would probably think, I don't know, it seems like people who are just faking it and trying to pretend like they saw 9/11 when really they didn't. We would assume, take it at face value. So why would we treat the gospel accounts any differently? Because there are minor differences in them. I should probably point out that differing accounts does not always mean contradiction. In fact, it implies authenticity. If the accounts were identical, that would imply copying or collaboration. If you had these people who are in the same sequence giving the exact same details, wouldn't you assume that they may be huddled up and kind of came up with this is the story we're all going to tell, right? So the fact that they're a little bit different and you do see these differences actually gives credibility. It doesn't take it away. Secondly, the accounts are different, but they are not contradictory, because no author ever claims to give a complete list of those going to the tomb. The time differences of was that sun up or not can actually be explained because some of them are describing time of departure and some of them are describing time of arrival. And if you read it carefully, you can tell that that's what's going on. So there was an explanation to account for the differences, although I think, again, just taking it at face value, you might assume, oh, these are contradictory, especially if someone is suggesting that they're contradictory. Although I think if you viewed this the way a historian would, you would see these are contradictory in a way that actually adds credibility, not takes it away. So I have to say that before we go on further. Also worth noting, I did not give this underlined part, which is also in Luke, where he says, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Joanna, also the other women with them. So there was a group of people, and clearly the authors kind of mentioned who they remembered being there. But none of them say, Mary Magdalene, by herself with no one else, went to the tomb. I mean, there's nothing like that. It's just that there was a group, and they mentioned the ones that they know were there. There's a reason why Mary Magdalene's name would stick out, as we will see when we go throughout this story. But none of these lists claim that, like, well, yeah, Mark got it wrong. Can't believe you said Salome. We all know it was Joanna. You know, it's not like that. Anyway, let us continue with our story. So early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one that Jesus loved. A quick aside on that. Most people, myself included, agree that that is John. Whenever he says that he's talking about himself. And said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. John likes to talk about aphasias. he bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. They wrapped the bodies in linen. That's why they're talking about this, is because, you know, he had risen, and the linen that they had used to wrap his body was there, and yet his body itself was not. So that's what they're describing here. But this is a little bit interesting. I want to dwell on this for a while, because the reaction of Jesus' followers to his missing body could be described as total shock. This is, you know, why weren't they the ones who are like, all right, guys, it's Sunday. Remember Jesus said after 3 days, let's go check it out. Let's see where he is. No. They were sitting at home, being sad, doing whatever it is that they were doing. The women were preparing to, like, further continue the burial process. It got interrupted before because, you know, the Sabbath was about to start, and they basically couldn't get everything done, so they left it. And we're like, we'll finish the rest of the embalming with the various herbs and, you know, embalming whatever that they used. So here they are, fully expecting to find his body, and then, whoops, not there. And they are completely shocked beyond all measure. It's worth mentioning that Jesus' enemies, on the other hand, saw this whole thing coming and actually had made plans in advance for, you know, what's going to happen on the third day. Let's look at this from Matthew. The next day, the one after the preparation day, so being Saturday, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will rise again. So here they were listening to what he said. We remember that while he was still alive, he said, after 3 days, I will rise again. And they were, you know, assuming that something is going to happen after 3 days and, you know, put this plan in place that we're about to read about. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he is raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go make the tomb as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. So, it's again, the disciples heard so much more from Jesus about how many different times he had said, I'm going to die and on the third day rise again. I'll give you no sign except the sign of Jonah, who was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, and so the Son of Man will be 3 days, three nights in the heart of the earth. He told them this a lot, but they still weren't expecting it. I mean, why were they surprised in the first place? I only point this out because I think a lot of us maybe assume, if I'm going to be in there with God, I probably should be, like, pretty good, a good person, doing lots of good things. Oh, yeah. Also, I better bring it in the having tons of faith department. If God likes that, I better bring my A game with the faith. He wouldn't be very happy if I was, like, asleep at the wheel and not having faith and not paying attention and all these kinds of things. Wouldn't that make God angry? Well, maybe not as angry as you might think, as we will soon see. Okay, onward in our passage. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. So, yeah, I mean, that's helpful. That they were, you know, not quite putting everything together. The learned Pharisees sort of understood more how significant these different predictions and prophecies were, whereas the disciples, you know, bless their souls, were still kind of novices at figuring out how important different prophecies and predictions were. But at this point, he saw and he believed. So that, you know, he once giving that evidence and he saw the missing body, he's, you know, started, the lights started to come on, he put it together and began to believe. Good for him. You know, I did not live 2,000 years ago, so I did not get to see, and that makes it a little different for me or for any of you. We do not get to see him after he rose from the dead, so what are we supposed to do? We can't go into the tomb and be like, oh, I guess it's still empty, and have that be significant for us, but more on that in a second. Anyway, so the disciples went back to where they were staying. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head, the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken away my Lord," or they have taken my Lord away, she said, and I don't know where they have put him. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was still the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have carried him, or where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God." Mary Magdalene went to the other disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. So this is kind of interesting here. I mean, as Jesus now is not just a missing body and there's some linens around, is now actually appearing to Mary. A couple of language that I really like here, he's like, "Go tell my brothers and tell them." And then he's like, "I'm going to ascend to my Father, oh, and your Father, and to my God and to your God." So he's really sort of drawing these parallels about how he feels that camaraderie with us, and he feels like you guys, the ones that I know, are my brothers and sisters, and that we all have the same God, and we're all going to be together afterward. With that in mind, it's also helpful to remember that Jesus, who picked Mary to be the first person he appeared to, and Mary Magdalene was a woman whom seven demons had been in her body, so it wasn't like he found, like, "I wonder who, like, does the most community service and is also, like, the coolest, smartest, richest, most spiritual person. Ha! I'll go talk to them." I'm sorry, I'm pointing at you, but not really. He appears to a woman who had seven demons come out of her. You know, you'd think, like, wouldn't that be someone you'd be kind of, like, embarrassed to be associated with if you're God and you have all of this holiness and goodness and all this and that? Yeah, well, God doesn't see it that way. Apparently, he really values each and every one of us, regardless of background, regardless of how many difficulties we've had, regardless of all the various sins we've committed. I mean, who was it that Jesus was spending his time with when he was on earth? He was always getting in trouble for being with the tax collectors, being with the prostitutes, being with those who, you know, had wild lives that, you know, were sinners. Were people that were broken, that were messed up. A lot of the disciples even fit into that camp, and instead of being like, "Go get those guys who used to be terrible," he's like, "Go get my brothers." I mean, he really does view these people as people that he loves, as people that he enjoys being with. We could be those people. Despite not only the things that we have done in the past, what about the bad things we're continuing to do even now? What about the bad things we're continuing to do in the future? I get stuck sometimes imagining, well, those times that I had that were really cool with God was when I really brought it, and I kind of was like, "Did you see how faithful I was there? Oh, did you see that money I just gave to help the poor? God, yeah, let's hang out." You know, and we kind of imagine that that's like when God's like, "Ah, yes, excellent. You are so good. I will now speak with you." Instead of imagining that, you know, you go up to God and be like, "Hey, God, remember me? I had all the demons inside of me." Like, but, you know, Mary understood this. I mean, she ran up and wanted to hug him. She got it. She got that he really did accept her and that he didn't view her as like, well, a woman who has the following problems, who is broken and messed up. He viewed her as a sister. He viewed her as someone that he loved. And that, I think, is a really powerful message. Who, you know, gets appeared to first except for one of the most broken people that he ever met throughout his entire ministry? And I think that that is an important thing for us to remember, that God's not looking for the people who've got the really excellent life already put together. He's looking for the people who know that they need help. And that doesn't matter if they've lived a crazy life of insane partying and crimes and terrible things, or if it's someone who's lived a relatively normal life or even a good life. Any of us that are willing to turn to him and ask for help are the ones that he, you know, wants to turn toward and to have that loving relationship. And even the people who have probably resisted that are still people that he died for and people that he wants to have a relationship with. Anyway, onward in our story. On the evening of the first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Now Thomas, also called Didymus, which just means twin, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. And the other disciples told him, "Oh, we have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, put my fingers where the nails were, and put my hands into his side, I will not believe." Poor Thomas. I mean, he only comes up as having said something one other time, and it's like this really negative, snarky comment. And then this. And that's all she wrote for Thomas. He's not probably the most beloved disciple. Maybe because of that, I kind of like Thomas. I do this. I, like, sometimes double down on the wrong thing. No, it's like this. I promise, I swear, blah. And, you know, really come out strong on the wrong topic, and then somebody comes in with proof that I'm wrong, and I'm like, oh. I mean, no way would it be worse than what he has happened, which we'll go ahead and read. It says, a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hand. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." So this is actually also an important interaction because, you know, again, the picture of these followers of Jesus are not just like these glowing, perfect saints who are just like levitating around being holy all the time and never making mistakes. Here's Thomas like pounding his fist like, "I know you didn't see him, you're all liars." Blah. And then Jesus is just like, "All right, so you wanted to touch my hands? What are you going to say now?" You know what I mean? He doesn't rub it in his face, though, and he's not, like, angry. Oh, my gosh. If I did something like this, I would just feel like, and then Jesus showed up and lasers came out of his eyeballs and my head exploded. And it's a good thing I'm not God. But that's not the, you know, he does correct them. He's just like, "You should stop doubting and believe. It's not good that you were doubting. I mean, why would you doubt your friends? What motive would they have for, like, yeah, literally all of us saw this happen, and we just, when you were out of the room, we thought we'd make up this story just to mess with you." You know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But because he didn't see, there was just some part of him that just couldn't accept, you know, like, if it's not my experience, it's like it doesn't count. And I think many of us feel the same way. Like, if I hear from my brother or my friend, "Oh, God has changed my life in the following way. I used to, you know, be addicted and have all of these, you know, difficulties, but then, you know, God has really changed my life, and he has, you know, repaired my relationships, and he's, you know, taught me about forgiveness, and he's taught me how to love and to forgive and to have a life that's so much more free." And I could hear that and be like, "Yeah, you could have just made that up. I don't know." You know what I mean? And it doesn't necessarily sink in. Hopefully it does. Hopefully that something like that, we are able to trust those who are around us. But it's fair to say that believing without seeing is difficult. I mean, let's not all, you know, glare at Thomas and talk about how stupid he is. Sometimes it's really hard to believe in something that you don't have that 100% assurance of, "My own senses show me this. You know, I don't know for 1,000% that it's true." And that, for sure, and many of us, is going to be able to generate doubt. However, when you are able to believe without seeing, that's something that is very powerful. Something that Jesus said, you know, would allow us to be blessed. Those who have not seen and still believed, you know, they will be blessed. I also need to point out, believing without seeing is actually much more common than you might think. And even though maybe you do count yourself as someone who, I need to see it to believe it, I need this to be, you know, my experience directly, there's no way that I could believe in something that I don't have firsthand knowledge of, I pose to you the following scenario. Have you ever taken a commercial flight? So, you really legitimately packed your bags, went to the airport, which is like always a nightmare, doesn't matter what city it is. You went through all the scans, went through all the waiting, all the money, so that you could get on a plane that you have literally never seen in your life, and you thought that it would arrive. Right? How absurd. A plane you've never seen. You're trusting the word of a person you've never met, and yet you showed up there and went through all these difficulties so that you could do it. And yet, I'm sure that any of us here who've been to an airport expected that it would arrive. Which is probably foolish, to be honest, because they don't always arrive. But, you know, you can believe because you trust the source. I suppose I do trust Delta or whomever when they say that this plane's going to come, or even if it doesn't come, I trust that the airline's going to make it right. And if they don't, then what? I'll be angry at them. Maybe I'll get on Yelp and tell everybody how stupid Delta is or something. You know, I mean, we do this, though. I mean, we put our faith in stuff we don't see all the time. Even if part of us is kind of like, I don't know if I completely 100% trust them, but I trust them enough to give them money, and I trust them enough to pack my bags, and I trust them enough to show up. So maybe you don't have to have 100% belief that, like, without a doubt in my mind, I know for a fact that every single thing that God says is absolutely true. Well, that's not actually what God is asking for. He's asking instead for enough trust to move toward him in the first place. When we have that relationship with God, that is when we get a lot of the actual, you know, confirmation, and we are able to see, for instance, from our own experience of how he's working in our lives, and we're able to, you know, basically continue to build in the faith that we have. But we don't show up with the finished product of like, here you go, God, perfect faith. I literally just believe you no matter what. That is not what he's asking for. There's a great story earlier, I don't have it on the screen, which I should, but where, you know, a guy is coming and trying to get Jesus to heal his son. And he's like, if you can heal him, then maybe you can come and do this. And Jesus is like, what do you mean, if? And he's like, I believe that you can, but help me with my unbelief. And then Jesus is like, screw you, man, you said if. No, but that's not what happened. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But that was good enough. I mean, he was like, yeah, okay, help me with my unbelief, deal. He had something, enough to move forward, enough to ask God to move toward God in the first place, and that was enough. And God, you know, is looking for that same thing from us. Not just if you don't have a relationship with God. I mean, certainly that would be a good place to start. Even for those of us who have a relationship with God, though, I know that we run into stuff that we have difficulty believing. Like, oh, geez, is God really going to come through in this scary scenario? Is God really going to, like, be able to provide for my family and take care of stuff? Oh, I don't know, if I do this scary thing over here, is maybe that will make my friends think I'm stupid if I tell them about God. Can I really trust him in that scenario? Or any number of scenarios. There's so many scenarios where, you know, will we believe the promises that God gives us? Or will we wait until we've, you know, or like Thomas, like, well, when I can put my fingers in the holes and stick my hand in his side, then I'll take a step. Or are we able to, you know, maybe trust the source a little bit. Maybe we could trust God more than we trust Delta. Potentially. Hopefully. Anyway, onward in our story. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So there's John 20. We do still have one more chapter, which is cool. But if you haven't been with us, I think it's worth your while. John is not like a really long and difficult book to read through. And we get this promise here that, like, look, I wrote down what I wrote down here so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. Having the opportunity to have a personal relationship with God, to be forgiven, not just moving backward in our lives, but even moving forward in our lives for the things that we'll continue to not do right, is something that is such a valuable offer that the investment of reading through, potentially, a book like John, maybe even reading through and asking God, like, maybe I have unbelief, Lord. Maybe by turning to just reading through this book so that I might believe, maybe you can show me something. Maybe you can reach out to me. Maybe you can show me that you are real and help me to overcome whatever unbelief I feel like I might have. I do encourage you to, you know, look through the book of John. It's something that I guarantee you'll find worthwhile, even if you've read it before. So to conclude, the first part, the gospel accounts, they really do complement rather than contradict each other. Some of the gospels, too, it's also probably important to mention, when you're reading through Matthew, you can't help but read a paragraph before he says something to the effect of, this was to fulfill the scripture, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he's got his angle that he's working. He's like, I want to show you all these parts in the Old Testament have their connection and the way that Jesus came onto earth. And this is how it all works out. And it's all part of the same message that we've been reading about all this time. Luke, who is writing from a different perspective, who's a Gentile, is sort of he had interviewed people and put together an account that would have been more accessible to those who did not grow up reading all of the Old Testament stories, and yet see how even those of us who don't have the heritage of always following God can still have a relationship with him. So he's coming from a different point of view. Whereas John is also coming from a different point of view where, you know, he is like, I'm not going to make an exhaustive story about everything that happened. I'm going to give you some signs that Jesus performed so that you may believe. So since they're writing at different, you know, motives and different purposes, of course there's differences. And those differences are not like, whoa, I can't believe it. If God would have wrote it, then literally every letter would have been the same in all four Gospels, which would be the worst read of all time. But, that's not how it works. And it actually is more reliable because of those differences. The second thing is that Jesus is very patient with our disbelief. You know, I can't believe that we don't even read the part in John where Jesus is like, seriously, guys? I mean, Mary and them showed up to the tomb, but where were you? I mean, the Pharisees, they were the ones who sent guards there. Even they heard the part where I said I was going to come back after 3 days and you guys were sitting with your door locked at home. But that's not how he comes off. He instead is much more patient with them. He's much more, forgiving and, you know, willing to deal with their disbelief. I mean, we are hard on ourselves about, well, I don't completely know about this, or, oh, sometimes I feel like maybe God is going to be angry with me, but that's not the story that we actually see in the Bible. That's not the God we're reading about here. He's much more patient and much more loving than we give him credit for. Last point here is that we can choose to believe without seeing. We probably already choose to believe in certain things without seeing. It's easier than you might think. And if we do choose to believe without seeing, and that, again, goes not only for those of us who don't have a relationship with God, but even those of us who maybe have had a relationship with God for a very long time. We could choose to believe those promises that God gives us in his Bible. We could choose to believe that God is going to bless our efforts when we step out in faith. Or we could be scared, and we could be reserved, and we could be like, not until I can put my fingers in his hands, like Thomas did. We're going to be loved and accepted regardless, so that's a relief, but when we do step out and we are able to, you know, believe without seeing, we are the ones to benefit the most. Not to mention, you know, those of us who are in our lives that we love. Okay, so, this week, oh, is that this week? Yeah. Disregard. Okay, if it's your first time here, you can get a free book at the Welcome Center over that away. Also, if you were here and you got one of the little packets, there's probably a feedback card there, and you can fill that out and tell us what you liked, didn't like, and whatever. And as we're passing the basket around, that's, you know, for church members who consider this church to be their church and consider this to be their home, can, you know, give donations to the church. However, if you're a guest, we don't want you to feel any obligation to give, because this is just for our members who want to support this. And if you are a guest here, we want you to just be that. Just be a guest and enjoy it. Or don't enjoy it, hopefully enjoy it. If you are a parent and you have children back in the Oasis program, then you can try to get to them by 11:45, lest they escape. And all right, if anybody else has any questions, comments, stories, etc., you can raise your hand and they will bring a microphone to you.
So this is kind of a weird question, but I know you think through these things. Why do you think Mary did not recognize it was Jesus when he appeared at the tomb? Was he in a different kind
of... That is a good question. I don't have, like, a perfect steel trap answer for you, except to say that there's two guys who were walking with them as they went to the town called Emmaus also had the same issue. And apparently he must have had some sort of difference in appearance, I'm guessing. Or maybe it's just that they so did not expect to see Jesus that it just never even entered their mind that maybe it is. I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. If somebody else has thoughts about it, I'm sure that they could chime in. But it is possible that, you know, their last image of him all being roughed up and, you know, really, you know, dirty and just, yeah, having issues, maybe stuck in their mind, and then here he was risen and not having those kinds of issues. Maybe it just seemed so different that it was hard to recognize. I just don't know. I mean, that's a good question, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I've often had that same question, and I thought, gosh, it was when he spoke to her and she heard his voice. And I think, you know, sometimes you just really strongly hear the voice of the Lord, you know, either encouraging you or directing you.
Yeah.
By the power of the Spirit. So I think
that's
kind of a cool thing, like, that I like to think happened, but I don't know for sure. But the thing I was going to say is I loved that the way that Jesus approached Thomas. And it just kept me mindful of the fact that Jesus approaches people with what they need.
Yeah.
And he's not a jerk about it or hard about it, but he knows what each individual needs to trust him.
Yeah.
And I think we can be confident going out that he goes before us preparing and showing somebody what they need.
Yeah.
And then our part is to follow after him, I guess.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I think... I would probably give someone else the advice of, like, God's patient with you, it's like this, it's like that. But when I think about myself, I imagine God's angry with me if I didn't believe or if I was having difficulty. But, yeah, I mean, I think that he does give us what we need, and you don't see those negative encounters when somebody does turn to the Lord. Yeah. Oh, whomever, yeah.
I'll fight you for it. Don't make me come over there. I was kind of camping out. First of all, I love the part where you remind us that just because it looks contradictory or different doesn't mean that it cancels it out, the Bible.
Right.
That because those are the challenges in my experience that people bring. Oh, you know, it's full of this, it's full of lies, it's full of contradictions.
Sure.
No. That just means there are different people talking. It's all the same. So I appreciate that. And then, too, I am so right there when you mentioned the man who was like, yeah, I believe, but I got this other part that is struggling. That is so my life.
Yeah.
Because it's like I want to be in the boss of everything with kids and grandkids. And it never really works out.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, in case anybody else wants to do that, don't. But it's the part you know God's always going to show up because you have this past history, you have these monuments, but it's so flipping scary in the moment, and I just appreciate the part where he understands that and doesn't be, you know, he's not just like, you didn't believe enough, so no, the answer's right. no, you know, and you're like, oh, he's so patient and loving and caring with us. I think he gets that, and I appreciate that, you know, that he does hear us. He will answer us. He will help us. He's there.
Yeah.
And if we're honest and tell him, you know, this is hard, he gets that. So, thanks.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, just saying that the faith the size of a mustard seed is what he's asking for, not, you know, Mount Rushmore or whatever. So, yeah.
This may sound a little bit too realistic, but I have to bring out that when my husband went home to God, the minute he took the last breath on earth, his total face changed. I knew it was him, but if somebody didn't know him, knew him for the last 15 years, or through his sickness, they wouldn't have recognized him. His face, his kidney, liver, everything was gone, so it was all jaundice and all really painful face. And the minute he took the last breath on this earth, his face turned to pink and the skin smooth, totally changed. For how long, I cannot remember. I was just in a trance, but everybody, all my family, his kids, grandkids, were there, and they all agreed. They all saw the transformation. I kind of understand. If you didn't know him when he was a baby, no one would have guessed that was him. And another thing is that I love Thomas because he just directly asked, but I don't think he's being jerk. He's just very sincere.
Yeah.
So sincere, God answers. So that means, like you said, we can ask anything we want as long as we sincerely, honestly ask him. Of course, if we are sincere, we're not going to ask for whatever, the Cadillac, expensive car.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, over there. Yeah, thanks for that.
I remember a couple years ago, and for the last couple of years, the question of help me with my unbelief, I was struggling. Well, what is it that you want me to believe? What is it that I need to improve my belief in? And the resounding answer was clinging hold to the transformative power of the Holy Spirit. And so in a, you know, like you're looking at family members or at your own life, and there's failure that you see and it's not where you want to be, it's a real challenge to, and I remember saying, I believe in the transformative power of the Holy Spirit. And just that's kind of repetitive a lot of times in my prayer, in terms of empowering me, changing me, and then also wanting to see victory in other people's lives. So,
yeah. No, that's really cool. It is something where there are times where you don't question it at all, and it's so easy, but yeah, it just slips away. So it is really helpful to have those, you know, ways to kind of just drag you back, like, look, I know that this is for real. I've seen it. This is good, and you know, I can turn to this. So yeah, it's helpful advice. Yeah,
it's always blown my mind that these disciples have traveled around with Jesus for what, 3 years or so, and seen all these miracles, and then when he dies and comes back like he tells them that he's going to do, it's like they don't believe it. Like, they don't expect it. It's like, me, that's the first thing I'm going to ask him when I'm up there is, what is your problem? Because he has done miracles in my life. And if I were to voice those miracles, someone might say, well, that's just life. Those things, you know, are bound to happen eventually. Mm. That doesn't mean it was God doing it. But he did them in such a way that I know that he did them, and it wasn't just the universe, you know, playing out what would come naturally.
Sure, yeah.
So that's just, I just wanted to make that comment that these men must have been, I don't know, lunatic or whatever you want to say, but to not believe the miracles that they see right in front of their faces, and then for God or for Jesus to tell them what's going to happen when he dies on the cross, and then when it happens, they don't believe it. But my theory for why he looked a little bit different has always been that the Bible says when we die, our bodies will change.
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe that was his way of just reiterating that, that, you know, I died and rose, so my body changed a little bit, so that, you know, it would just, like, I don't know, cement that idea or that truth in your head that you will also change.
Yeah, I think that that's very possible. I mean, obviously, his body was different to some extent because he walked through the locked door. So there obviously were some changes that had happened, and yet he still did have, you know, the scars and things like that. I mean,
right.
But, yeah, that's cool. I think it is frustrating. I mean, especially for the, you know, the three that got to see him transformed into his true form on top of a mountain, that they somehow never put it together. But we do have the benefit of hindsight and are able to kind of look at the whole thing. I know sometimes situationally it's real different, you know what I mean? I've kicked myself so many times for being like, why did I not think this was going to work out, you know what I mean? So it happens. And it's okay that it happens, because God's patient with us.
Yeah, so. I'm the kind of person who has to have proof for everything, and I'm always asking why. Most of my friends know that I always ask why, and sometimes that gets me in trouble. So I think that the reason he showed me the miracles that he showed me was because he knew that I probably wouldn't believe unless he did something special for me.
Yeah, and he does move toward us. I mean, you know, he's not begrudging the people who are asking for the more. You know, when Gideon had been given his miraculous sign, he's like, I want another one. And God's like, yeah, okay. So it's all right to ask for those things. Cool. Well, we'll take one more and then wrap around up.
Okay, Joe, I agree with the point. I think I heard it right, that a lot of Christians want to be qualified to be on the inside crowd with God.
Yeah.
Right? And we instinctively believe, most of us anyway, that, you know, we have to earn our way to that. Right? We have to be in right standing.
Definitely.
According to what I do or don't or avoid doing.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I think the irony of that is we have to be free from that kind of a legalistic perspective to have any hope of qualifying at all.
Right?
And I say that principally based on Galatians 1, where you see the Apostle Paul making the point in earnest two different times in that chapter, where he, and this is unprecedented as I understand it in the New Testament, he condemns people to hell who would have the gall to try to weave into the grace message works, which is what we're talking about here. I earn my way. And if Paul made it such a profound point in Galatians that has no place in the message of God. We need to believe that. We need to trust that I can't qualify myself. And I need to kind of have a radical, abandoned sort of trust in the grace message for myself.
Definitely.
And that is what qualifies me.
Yeah, and that is a scary thing, because you see such strong language, and yet it's strong language defending how it's a free gift and how it's actually God who's, you know, moving toward us. And it's actually a much more encouraging message, you know, when you understand it. Because I think that it is so easy for us to kind of imagine ourselves being so much more than we are. Like, you know, if the governor gives you a pardon and you get out of prison, you're like, yeah, he noticed I was pretty sweet. That's what happened. You know what I mean? It's like, no, he pardoned you. That is not because you had the cleanest cell. But that we like to think that way.
Oh,
sorry, yeah.
In
Philippians 3, the question. The question about how was Jesus recognizable or not recognizable?
Oh, yeah.
Gentiles eat pork chops. 3:20 and 21. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we eagerly await for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of his glory by the exertion of the power that he has to subject all things to himself. You know, there is a radical transformation leaving this life to the next. That's what that message is. So the fact that Jesus would look in some manner different is just consistent with the text.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know how much he was glowing because the people on the road to Emmaus just thought he was a regular guy, but it definitely, you know, says that, look, John the Baptist is as good as anyone who has ever lived, and even the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So, you know, we do get that promise of amazing transformation and a new body, which I'm first in line for, so that's nice. I mean, that's one of the many great promises that we get. Cool. Well, let's go ahead and pray. If you want to pray, you can raise your hand and they will bring a mic to you and I will close us up.